This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Today on Keeping the Faith, we're talking with an urban geographer about gentrification and the kind of inequality that's often a result of that. Professor David Wilson from the University of Illinois. Welcome, David.
Thank you, Steve. Nice to be here.
Good to have you on the program. How did you first get interested in gentrification? And tell us what it is. I mean, we've all heard the term. We know it means sort of things are improving in big cities, but are they?
Well, I got interested in gentrification as a result of being born and raised in New York City. And I lived in New York. And when I was relatively young, we moved to the suburbs of New York City. And as I moved through my life course, I ended up in city after city. So in particular, I spent time in Albany, New York, and lived in Philadelphia and New Brunswick, New Jersey, and even ended up in Indianapolis, Indiana, which is a major city. And as a result, over that period, I became increasingly interested in cities, and especially the plight of cities, the problems that cities face, and how cities can grow, and some of the inequalities that cities face.
Now, when people hear the term gentrification, they often think that's a very positive thing. Is it always?
Well, gentrification is seen by many people, particularly in the policy community and in the conventional political community, as something that is quite positive. Because gentrification is fundamentally a changing or a restructuring of places, and especially of downtowns and of neighborhoods. And gentrification promises the possibility of new investment and new kinds of populations and a new kind of growth that in the eyes of many seems to recharge cities. The process of gentrification, however, is often more complex than that because it's something that incurs costs as well as benefits. And whether the benefits outweigh the costs has become a very contentious issue in many cities and across America. The principal cost that is incurred from gentrification is a process of residential displacement, that is, of populations that have an increasingly difficult time staying in neighborhoods as they become hot for new investment and hot for new speculation.
I was talking with Esther Patt, who's on the city council in the city of Urbana, earlier today, and she was asking who was going to be on the program and what the topic would be. And when I mentioned gentrification and you, she said, well, what makes her just furious is that when various government folks go into an area that's perhaps public housing where very poor people live, Section 8, whatever, and ask people, well, now we're going to make this place better, we're going to fix it up, we're going to bring in new apartments, what would you like in those apartments? And what they don't seem to tell people is that it's going to be too expensive for them to live there.
Right.
Does that actually happen?
Yes, it does happen. It happens very often. Although what you're referencing is a very interesting process, and it involves government programs, in particular the federal government and local government, where they can come into neighborhoods and come into communities, and they can offer programs that displace households and families. And it becomes increasingly more difficult for households and families to live in those areas. But by law, if a family deals with that sort of hardship and it's a result of a government program, there's supposed to be some sort of compensation for that, some sort of economic compensation. Gentrification, technically, is a private sector process. It's a private sector phenomenon whereby private housing markets in cities heat up, and it's driven by speculators and developers and property owners to some degree. And The result is that when there's increased land values, rental fees will often go up, and there'll be greater tax burdens incurred upon homeowners, and some families will have to bail out. They have no choice. They can't make those payments. So gentrification, since it's a private sector phenomenon and doesn't at least directly involve government, will not involve any sort of compensation on the part of government. So that accentuates the dilemmas.
One distinction we need to understand right off, it sounds like, and you'll have to excuse me because I've never taken a course in urban geography, but apparently is between the government programs and this private phenomenon that takes place with homeowners, speculators, and so on. And you say with government programs, can they force people to sell if they own the property, or do people tend to not own the property? They tend to be renters, I presume?
It's all of those.
Okay.
In a very complex process. Government, if in the final instance, if it's offering something like an urban renewal program, and urban renewal actually no longer exists as a separate government program, but it's done under the auspices of a different kind of thing now. But urban renewal activities are still undertaken, and it involves demolition, you know, bringing in a bulldozer, knocking down houses. If government deems that it is in the public interest, however the public interest is defined, then they technically have the right to seize land that's owned by private citizens. And it's a direct intervention or involvement on the part of government.
What level of government usually does that?
It's actually, it often will involve all levels of government.
Okay.
So, for example, there'll be enabling legislation at the state level. It'll be done under the auspices of the federal government. For example, the Department of Housing and Urban Development. But often it's propelled by local government. Local government establishes an agency that helps the process, that drives the process along. So government's actively involved. Now, gentrification is technically, as I say, not a government initiative. But indirectly, government can have a major influence on the process, it seems. So government, you know, gets out of the way of paying compensation for displaced families and households. But through indirect means, they can actually help drive the process. So that, in a way, heightens the controversy.
What are some of the ways that local governments can do that?
Government has an array of programs that, it seems, can stimulate gentrification. One is historic preservation, right? Historic preservation is often seen as kind of a harmless program. It's just identifying history, it's identifying culture, and once it locates those in a community or in a neighborhood, it designates that neighborhood a historic district. But once that's done, interestingly enough, that can indirectly drive gentrification, because all of a sudden the neighborhood becomes much more prestigious. And when a neighborhood becomes more prestige-oriented, all of a sudden builders and developers will often rediscover that neighborhood and say, wait a second, this is a good opportunity potentially to sink money into housing and to buy up property. And the process is initiated. Another program is tax increment financing, or TIF as it's called. Tax increment financing is especially big in Chicago. Chicago is the TIF capital of America. And TIF basically is a program where taxes, local property taxes, which are generated from a community, are plowed right back into that community or plowed right back into that neighborhood. And the additional infusion of new money, of new investment, can directly generate the process of gentrification.
Where my wife and I went to church when I was in seminary in Chicago was on the south side, 61st and Kimbark in Woodlawn, that neighborhood. Mm. And at the time, it was almost completely poor and almost completely African-American. But the First Presbyterian Church was there, and it had retained maybe half to 60% of the population were people who came back to that neighborhood, although they'd moved away, and tended to be white, Asian, other than African American. And gentrification has hit that neighborhood very strongly. It's just south of Hyde Park, of course, right. University of Chicago. And many of the poor people, their homes have been bulldozed. There may be a few new things there, but they're just one vacant lot after another. But the value of those lots has gone way up.
Exactly. Yeah. It's one of the curious ironies of gentrification, where not only is it a process whereby neighborhoods are upscaled or upgraded and more affluent families and households move in, but for many neighborhoods that surround it, you see a process of just the opposite, of disinvestment, of decline. And what's going on, apparently, is that for every new dollar that comes into a gentrified neighborhood, that's $1 that's kept away from other neighborhoods. Oh. And so you have this interesting process whereby you have these islands of revitalization often forming. And then you go two or three blocks or four blocks away, and you have just the opposite. You have intensive decline and disinvestment.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Professor David Wilson from the University of Illinois Department of Geography, talking about urban geography and gentrification. We encourage listeners to join these conversations on Sunday evenings here on Keeping the Faith. Do give us a call. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If it's a long-distance call, do use our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. That includes listeners on the Internet. Anywhere in the continental U.S., you may call us with that toll-free number, 1-800-222-WILL. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these programs, and although I seem to have a bit of a frog in my throat today, I'll be asking questions, but eager to have people join me. So do give us a call if you have a comment or an experience to share with our guest, Professor David Wilson. David, your specialty is Chicago, and you say it's the TIF capital of America. How did Chicago, why is Chicago like that?
Chicago is a very interesting city, and in certain ways, it's very symptomatic of what a lot of cities in America are experiencing. Over recent years, there has been an increased drive to go global. That what's going on in America today is this preoccupation with cities like Chicago to be internationally competitive. And the term that's often thrown around to represent that is the term globalization. So Chicago has become obsessed is too strong a word, but very concerned about its place in the global economy and its global standing. And the operative feeling is that Chicago has to be able to attract resources and has to be able to attract jobs and new investment, or else it will fall into a kind of eclipse. So what Chicago has become especially interested in, and Mayor Daley articulates this very openly, is that to be competitive, we need to spruce up our neighborhoods. We need to present a sellable city. We need to establish on the ground the kinds of amenities and the kinds of facilities and the kinds of communities that will attract new investment and make Chicago globally competitive.
We have several callers waiting to join the conversation. Let's go to line four, our toll-free line. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith with David Wilson.
Yes, you've already talked about Chicago. Do you know anything about Atlanta during the Olympics, about them doing urban renewal?
I don't know that much about Atlanta, except that it is a city, apparently, that has a very long history of urban renewal in its downtown. And in the urban renewal of Atlanta, it's been a process whereby, under the auspices of the federal government, the federal bulldozer has been brought in, And it has been active in terms of changing the downtown and in what I'll call restructuring of Atlanta's core area. And the result has been apparently the building of high-rises, of new office buildings, and more upgraded neighborhoods have resulted. Now, what will... I guess the Olympic phenomenon has contributed to that, because when you gain access to the Olympics, you have it in your city, that becomes a new kind of focus for investment. And my hunch would be that that kind of designation would play directly into this idea of sprucing up Atlanta's core area and Atlanta's downtown.
I was living in the Southeast in the early 70s and frequently went to Atlanta to see friends and meetings and so on. And when the urban renewal process was going there, which was federally funded in that time at least, there were complaints, and to use the language of the time, that it was not urban renewal, it was Negro removal. Is there any truth to that accusation of white racism behind some of this?
Well, it's an empirical reality, I think. It's been very well chronicled that to a disproportionate degree, the households and the families and the people that have been forcibly displaced from the urban renewal program were African American. And the statistic I saw was that in the height of urban renewal, as much as 2 to 3% of America's housing stock was actually demolished in the process.
Wow.
That's extensive.
We have other callers waiting. Let's go to line number one. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith. Line number one, go ahead.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh. You know, I'm just curious because, you know, we don't think of ourselves as being part of Chicago, but Chicago really is along the route between New Orleans and the North and so on and so forth, and we're kind of in the middle of it, and we seem to have a situation where I think intentional neglect might be a good way to put our urban renewal and so forth at times. There are so many buildings that could house people and so on and so forth, but they're held by landlords that just don't want to do anything with them and, frankly, are just going to let them go to the point that they have to be torn down. And I'm wondering if you might address that in the context of major cities and, again, with us along the way.
Yeah.
Thank you for the question.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And I think that a process that goes on, which you're really addressing, is this reality whereby landlords will practice neglect of their properties. And often it's because they have a perception that their holdings are not producing enough revenue for them. So they're really not making enough money as a landlord, as an owner of property. But what often happens, or sometimes happens more precisely, is that property values will decline substantially. And at some critical moment during the course of that decline, it makes sense to demolish the property and to actually redevelop it. But neighborhoods have to and properties have to fall into extreme disrepair before that happens. Because at some point, it makes sense to buy land cheaply and redevelop them and then to kind of socially engineer demand for housing there. And that's actually how a lot of gentrification begins, in the very process you mentioned.
And we have another caller on line number two. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Yes, good evening. A question for Professor Wilson. In view of the name of the program, Keeping the Faith, what is the relationship between religion and gentrification? Is it a matter of keeping faith in gentrification?
That's a very interesting question. And keeping faith in gentrification. There is faith involved to our caller, but the faith has to be put in the area of hope that things are going to turn out for the better. Because there are families and there are households that are negatively predisposed by the process, that they can lose their homes. And faith comes in the arena of hope and betterment for a future.
Faith helps.
Well, faith is something which people can grasp onto. But in the final analysis, it's the political economy of the city that's going to determine whether things will be better for them or not.
So is it a matter of bitterness?
Bitterness can come into play, just like the array of emotions can come into play. And faith becomes a kind of something to grasp onto when your life is in turmoil and you are in a tumultuous stage of your life.
And do guns also help?
Do guns also help? I think not. I think guns have very little role to play in the process, no matter how angry or upset you get. There are other means to deal with the dilemma of being negatively affected by gentrification.
Thanks. Let me hang up now. Thanks.
Okay.
Appreciate the call. I know when I was involved in the seminary, the neighborhood in which McCormick Seminary was at that time was on the north side of Chicago, Halsted and Fullerton, which at the time was in decline. And some of the grand old homes that the faculty was still living in there in that area were beginning to crumble and fall apart and were very expensive to fix up. Some of them were turned from single-family homes into multifamily homes. Most of the landlords lived somewhere else. And the seminary was feeling that its students were in some danger because there were gunshots in the alleys and gang activity was increasing in that neighborhood. And so the seminary sold its property that had been there for I suppose, a century, and moved to Hyde Park. And that neighborhood then got gentrified. And the buildings that the seminary sold to DePaul University within the next 10 years became maybe 10 times as valuable as they were when they were sold.
Right. Well, let me respond to that in two ways. Let me suggest that gentrification is not an unequivocally negative phenomenon. There are benefits that are gained from the process, and there's little doubt about that. What are the benefits? Urban tax bases are replenished.
Sure.
Every city needs money. It needs revenues to pay for police protection, to pay for fire protection, to pay teachers, to update schools. All of that means money. And money doesn't grow on trees. It's got to be generated, especially through the local property tax. Gentrification is a process that bolsters local tax bases, and that's clearly a positive. It also fixes up physically downtowns, core areas, and communities. And I think there's something to be said for fixing up areas. Now, that said, the very process you describe, and I'm imaging it in my mind, Fullerton and Halsted, and it's been dramatically upgraded.
Oh, yes.
in my recollection. But it's a process whereby there were gunshots at one time and there was crime. So gentrification comes in and it improves the area. So where does the crime and the gunshots go? They go elsewhere.
Sure.
They get displaced. They get moved to another part of town, often to a less visible part of town. They don't go away. They fester somewhere else.
In the big movement of over the last 50, 60, 70 years of the growth of the suburbs around the major cities as places where often it's white flight, people leaving the inner cities, the central cities to get out to the suburbs. What do you see as a urban geographer now that some of those people are now moving back into the cities? What does this all mean?
What does it all mean? That's probably the most difficult question of all. What does it all mean? It means that we have a very complex metropolitan area in the United States today. On the one hand, we have decay, the problems of cities moving out to inner ring suburbs, and in fact, moving beyond inner ring suburbs. So you have kind of an urbanization of the urban issues being transposed on suburbs like never before. At the same time, you have people rediscovering cities who have become, to some degree, disillusioned with suburban living, the supposed sterility of being in the suburbs, who are finding urban environments much more appealing than ever before. So you have kind of a traditional reversal of some of the trends that have historically marked cities. But that said, there's still a lot of decline and decay and neglect in vast portions of cities. And that includes Indianapolis and St. Louis and Chicago and New York and Detroit and Cleveland and all those places.
And New Orleans.
And New Orleans, absolutely.
All right. We're talking on Keeping the Faith with Professor David Wilson from the Geography Department at the University of Illinois about gentrification and the kind of inequalities that are involved with that. I encourage listeners to call in with comments or questions or share experiences in Champaign-Urbana. There are several lines you can access by punching in 333-9455. Elsewhere, a toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We're about halfway through our program, but there's plenty of time for callers, so do give us a ring. Next week on Keeping the Faith, our guest will be Father James Ellison. We'll be talking about the Antiochian Orthodox Church. Father Ellison is a priest here in Champaign-Urbana. On May 18, we'll be having an archive program while I'm out of town. May 25th, our guest will be Wayne Wagers. We'll be talking about institutional design and evaluation of churches. June 1st, our guest will be Mark Gungor, whose recent book has been creating quite a stir on marriage and relationships. And June 8th, Professor of Dance Philip Johnson will be our guest. Let me remind you that the University YMCA, which provides support for these Keeping the Faith programs, will be starting Dump and Run starting tomorrow, Monday, the 8th of May. For the next 2 or 3 weeks, we'll be collecting things that students don't have room to take home to Chicago or wherever, and yet items that are still of use, and we collect them in big, huge collection boxes all around the campus and in the certified housing places, sororities, all sorts of places. And, of course, people can bring things by the Campus Y. That's on the corner of Chalmers and Wright Street. And these days with construction, it'll take a challenge for you to get there, but it can be done. Go on Arbery to get to Wright Street by the University Library and then one block north to the Y. You can pull in behind our building and drop off furniture and household items, and we'll have people there from 8:30 to 4 to help collect them and sort them. We have a lot of volunteers who put them in boxes and we put them on big trucks. Then we have this huge sale in the fall with new students and international students who appreciate those things. So it keeps trash out of the waste stream. It recycles things. It helps the Y with much-needed finances and gives people bargains who need it in the fall. So Dump and Run, if you aren't going to be cleaning out your house till later in the summer, you can bring things directly to the Stock Pavilion where the sale will be the last 2 weeks of August. Well, let's get back to our talk today about gentrification. We have a caller waiting on line number one. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith. Sorry to keep you waiting.
Yes, thank you. I find the show very interesting. I wondered, how does East St. Louis fit into all this? That town doesn't seem to be able to grow with the issue that you talked about. And it just sort of seems to be very stagnant and always in a state of, disrepair.
Yeah, East St. Louis is, in certain ways, I think, very much an anomalous community. It doesn't fit some of the ideas and the models that are out there. East St. Louis has direct proximity to downtown St. Louis. It's very close. And people could live in East St. Louis, and they could commute with relatively little hassle into downtown St. Louis and hold down jobs. And that kind of situation suggests that East St. Louis would be prime for a kind of revitalization in terms of bringing in more affluent populations, in terms of bolstering its tax base. But it doesn't seem to have worked. And I suspect that the population is so profoundly disadvantaged in East St. Louis that there are difficulties in terms of mobility and in terms of gaining access to the most basic things that other populations have. So revitalization has not occurred there, whereas you see similar types of communities across America that have revitalized, places like Camden, New Jersey, just across the river, the Delaware River from Philadelphia, northern Jersey, just across the river from New York City. But yes, that's a very good point. It hasn't happened in East St. Louis.
Do you want to follow up, caller?
Well, I just wondered, have they tried? I mean, I assume from your answer that they have tried. I just want to know, they tried, why didn't you think it worked? Just the demoralization of the people or the lack of resources?
I think it's some of those. East St. Louis has seen a lot of urban renewal and very destructive urban renewal. So that when you're in downtown St. Louis, it's kind of shocking the degree to which there are vacant lots, empty lots, and property owners have been unwilling to purchase them. That said, there's an initiative here at the University of Illinois that's been going on for some time now to help the indigent and the poor populations in East St. Louis. And my understanding is that that has been fairly successful, and that it's begun to give populations in East St. Louis a voice in terms of a potential vision for redeveloping the city. But what remains elusive is the private sector process, whereby builders and developers and speculators will come to discover land and property in East St. Louis, invest in it, and drive a kind of revitalization. So yes, there have been efforts. The urban renewal, in the opinion of numerous people, has not been successful.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for the call. Appreciate it. David, when you study urban renewal, gentrification, how do you go about it?
There are a number of ways to study urban renewal and or gentrification. You can study it through a kind of detached process whereby you model it, where you look for the possibility of assigning numbers to forces and processes in these places. And that's a very valuable way to understand something like gentrification. So, for example, you can count the number of people moving into these neighborhoods, count the number of people moving out. You can try to model that process. You can try to quantify or to add numbers to the amount of investment flowing in, how much potential investment could be flowing in. And that's one way to understand the process. Another way is to be actively engaged in these communities, in these areas of change, and in a way to get inside of them and to do what we call ethnographic work, where you go in and you talk to people. You talk to people on the streets. You talk to people on the ground. You go into institutions and you engage them. And you try to understand from that vantage point exactly what's going on.
And do you write short stories, novels, academic papers?
Yeah, I had a very brief flirtation with writing novels and short stories, and it proved an abysmal failure. So it's something that I will not do. But what comes out of this very often are papers, are academic papers. And it's to a relatively small audience. It's to people like myself and to policy people who make decisions about policy in cities. And hopefully it can generate or it can produce a positive outcome. I think it becomes important for policy people to recognize not just the benefits of gentrification, but to see some of the costs incurred and to very carefully weigh the complexities of the situation so that a truly informed decision can be made about whether, say, a city government wants to facilitate this process, to drive it forward, or whether it wants to slow it down.
We have another caller waiting on line number one, and other callers are encouraged, 333-9455 in the Champaign-Urbana area, elsewhere 1-800-222-9455. Go ahead, line number one.
Sorry to call twice in the same show, but this is really...
It's all right. I've asked more than one question.
Yeah. Anyhow, would you mind addressing the need for more egalitarian financing for gentrification if it is to be inclusive?
Yeah. It's, you know, that's a very interesting question, and also it's a very difficult one to take on, because there have been some cities that have recognized that there has to be some kind of inclusive investment. So, for example, numerous cities have adopted the strategy of trying to produce affordable housing as well as trying to promote gentrified housing. And the idea has been that often affordable housing can sit side by side with gentrified housing, and there can be a relatively peaceful coexistence with families and households who reside in that kind of neighborhood. But apparently the dilemma is that often it doesn't work. And it doesn't work because of the way housing markets operate. Once a housing market heats up and it becomes perceived to be a very valuable place for making money, that is, enormous profitability can result from buying up property and building condominiums and building co-ops and building apartments, then often the transformation will be dramatic and the affordable housing that's put in place will get swept away. So in theory, cities have tried to juxtapose affordable housing with gentrified housing, but very often it has not worked.
Thank you very much for the call.
I'm thinking, Steve, about you living in Chicago. I'm thinking about around the Newberry Library where, you know,
sure.
I mean, that is just totally gone and totally inaccessible to people at this point. And I worry about the same situation in Champaign. If you make gentrification or redevelopment so exclusive, and again, I don't know where the people go. I think it's just scary, but I'll hang up.
It can be terrifying to people who live in those neighborhoods.
Has the scattering of Section 8 housing throughout the city worked anywhere? I know it's been attempted.
I think there's mixed feelings about Section 8 as a program. If you gave me a truth serum, and I think you just gave it to me, I think my response would be that Section 8 has been a positive program.
Okay.
That it does bring in affordable housing that can stay for a while and resist that kind of gentrification process.
Okay. We have several callers waiting. Let's go to line number four, the toll-free line. Yes.
Yes. I was wondering what you predict will be happening with kind of the housing implosion. And how this is going to affect gentrification, and do you expect to see a lot of areas backsliding or stalling out in the middle? I mean, what do you feel the next 5 years is going to be after we've had this huge hiccup in the housing market?
Very interesting question. I have an opinion, and you should feel free to dissent. Because my hunch, and it really is a hunch at this point, just like other people are making hunches, because these things can be enormously difficult to predict. But the very devaluing of land and property that's probably going to result from this subprime mortgage fiasco, I'll call it a fiasco, where people, families, and households are unable to pay their mortgage requirements, that's going to result in the producing of a lot of inexpensive housing. There'll be a lot of vacant housing. And when there's vacant housing in abundance, that can actually set the stage for gentrification, which seems kind of ironic. But it sets the stage in the sense that builders and developers if they can socially engineer a demand for their product, for housing, and there's still families and households with money that can buy into it, they can seize vacant and devalued land and property, and it fits precisely into the whole formula of how many neighborhoods gentrify. So that's the twist on that's the irony to the process, I suspect.
But again, as that happens, the poor families who've lost their homes are not going to be able to afford to buy any of those places.
That's exactly it.
Right. Or it, perhaps even rent them.
That's right. So it's a very painful, afflictive process.
We have another caller waiting on line number two. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Thank you. I'd like your guest to comment on a hypothetical change to our property tax laws. Suppose property was assessed at the original purchase price for all time instead of current market value. Do you think that would mitigate against some of the evils that are concomitant with gentrification?
You know, I think that in the best of all possible worlds, it might slow the process of gentrification down and perhaps make it more egalitarian, but I'm not sure that would be the case. And I'm not sure that would be the case simply because gentrification is fundamentally driven, in my opinion, by a search for profitability. And it's a search for profitability on the part of builders and developers and to some degree of governments, because governments benefit financially as well, although it's not directly profits they're pursuing. Even with the change in tax code that you suggest, if there's a perception that a lot of money can be made by buying up land, buying up property, rehabilitating it, changing it, I think the change in tax code may have a minor effect. So that would be my hunch onto that.
But it would mean that people who don't want to sell wouldn't be taxed out of their homes.
Right. So it may benefit property owners much more so than renters. That's a good point.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call. And we'll go right to line number one with another caller. Yes, go right ahead.
Hi, what your guest just talked about speaks to what I was going to ask in some ways. I was earlier interested in your discussion about how your guest writes papers and these influence policymakers. But it seems to me that the way government works is that the decisions are made by elected council members, I think, who rely on political campaigns and donations to those campaigns, and therefore are very much influenced by developers who make a lot of money and are therefore have a big interest in decisions and are willing to throw money into political campaigns, and that really what was just talked about while I was waiting was the profitability for some enterprises involved in the redevelopment and gentrification is largely what drives this, and people like you and me may wring our hands about the injustices, but that's the way the world works, is that these developers are going to make a lot of money, so they're able to contribute to campaigns, and that's what's going to happen. I'm sorry if I didn't state this very well, but I'll hang up and listen to your response. Thank you very much.
I think you stated it very beautifully, and I think you're right on the mark. I think there's a reality to be faced, and the reality is one of the very connections that you point to. And the connections are that mayors are influenced by city councils, by city-county councils in some cities, and to a significant degree, often what's pushing the levers of public policy is the private sector and, you know, the world of influential builders and influential developers, and they can exert an enormous influence on city policy. And recognizing that, I also have to recognize that the kind of papers that I produce may have a minimal effect on public policy. But there's also, at times, kind of openings for innovative policy to be reformulated that can perhaps be juxtaposed against exactly what you describe. And that is when local government is faced with a controversy. You know, when people stand up in cities, in neighborhoods, and they say, we want to keep our neighborhood. You know, we've lived in this neighborhood for 40 years or 30 years, and we have significant ties to institutions there. And we have substantial affiliations with place. And with those substantial affiliations, we have a right to our neighborhood. And if that's publicized, that can create an awkward situation for local governments where to some degree they have to respond. And they have to respond even in the face of all of those connections that you very poignantly mentioned.
The connection between politics and property and ethics. Let's talk about that a little bit. What kind of ethical standards should cities have as they look at these kind of issues?
I think that's at the heart of the gentrification dilemma. I think that's a really, really good point. And the ethical dilemma is this. Who should our cities be for? On the one hand, one can make a case that, in fact, our cities should be determined by who has a right to buy into them. You know, let the private market decide. Sometimes it's called the neoliberal route of things. But it's the idea that the private market is efficient, it's effective, let the private market do its thing. And at the end of the day, if we follow the dictates of the private market, then we'll have an economically taught, well-structured city, and the people who can buy into neighborhoods have a right to those neighborhoods. But there's another take onto that. And the take is that cities should be represented and cities should be turned over for people who live there, for people who have established their roots there, people who have put down their connections to neighborhoods, and again, people who have affiliations with all kinds of institutions. And despite the fact that they may lack money, they should have input into how their city develops, how their city redevelops, and how a city grows. And that's at the heart of the ethical dilemma of gentrification. Because in the final analysis, gentrification says, look, let the private market decide. That should be the mechanism that determines who lives where. And there's a very strong argument that can be suggested to supplant that, to say, no, that's not the case at all. That's unjust and that's unfair.
Should American cities that are made up primarily of former immigrants welcome new immigrants? Should there be a mechanism? Should there be laws? Should there be ethical standards about welcoming new poor immigrants?
Well, given the history of America, I think a strong case can be made for the fact that by a simple examination of the historical record, it makes a lot of sense economically and socially and especially ethically to welcome people who have come from other places and find a place for them in the American economy, in the American social system. It makes sense to do so. Their labor is often needed. They often have a tremendous amount of things they can contribute to cities and to communities. But at the same time, there's a pervasive fear that's often mobilized in the service of keeping them distanced and keeping them in a temporary status. So in response to your question, yes. It makes a lot of sense ethically and socially and economically to welcome immigrants.
Is there room in America for more?
Well, you may be asking the wrong person, but I have a hunch again. And I think that there certainly is a room for more. And what I'm suggesting here is that labor markets across cities still require people to work in these positions. A dilemma, of course, is that a number of these slots in local occupational structures can pay low wages. They can be demeaning work. And that's the type of thing that has to be addressed politically, in my opinion. Nobody should be working under atrociously bad conditions. But it becomes possible to upgrade the nature of jobs. It becomes possible to upgrade the wages that immigrants receive. And at the same time, it becomes possible to assimilate them into the social structure of urban environments and in the social structure of America. It can be done.
We're talking tonight on Keeping the Faith about gentrification, inequality with Professor David Wilson. David, how long have you been at the University of Illinois in the Department of Geography?
I have been in Urbana-Champaign at the University of Illinois for 18 years. The time has gone very quickly.
Where were you before that?
I was born in New York City, and I lived there for a while. And then we lived in the suburbs.
Where did you go to college?
I went to college at SUNY Albany in upstate New York. And then for graduate work, I went to Temple University in Philadelphia and Rutgers University in New Brunswick.
What degree at Temple?
At Temple, I received a master's degree in geography.
A very urban university.
A very urban university.
What did you study there in Philadelphia?
I studied urban geography, and I actually did a master's degree.
But a special project or research?
Yes. I did a project on housing abandonment in North Philadelphia. North Philadelphia is a very disinvested part of Philadelphia. It's an area of a lot of physical decay. When I was there, there was this rampant problem of housing abandonment where landlords and property owners were walking away from properties. And they were doing that because they had a perception that not a lot of money could be made by holding on to property. And I became very interested in this phenomenon. And that's what I studied.
And what was your subject for your dissertation for your PhD?
This might be surprising, but the subject for my dissertation was gentrification. I actually studied gentrification in New York City. And at the time I was in residence there, I was going to graduate school, Manhattan was very much a transforming place. It was a borough where there was this incredible checkerboard of decline and disinvestment and tremendous upgrading. It's totally changed now. Now, nobody I know can afford to live in Manhattan.
Right.
It's across the board. Manhattan has dramatically gentrified.
And what was your research focus for the book that brought you to the University of Illinois, or the book you produced here?
There's actually a number of books I've produced.
Okay.
Which one should I describe for you? I recently finished a book on the new African-American low-income community in America.
Oh.
And it's a book about how in changing times of affluence that often we can see neighborhoods and especially racialized neighborhoods and in particular African-American communities being left behind. That there's a tremendous amount of inequity that still exists in urban America. And even during the dot-com boom of the 1990s and through the Bush administration, we see a growing disparity between wealthy neighborhoods and poor neighborhoods. And the book addresses that issue and the processes behind it.
Now, you play guitar with a blues band called the Painkillers that Carolyn Johnson sings with. How'd you get involved in urban blues?
You've done some spy work. I got involved with blues because at a very early age, I was influenced by blues music. And I was listening to it when I was in grade school and junior high and high school. And I picked up a guitar one fateful day, figured out some chords, and I said, this is not that difficult. I later discovered it was extremely difficult. And it's become more difficult as I age. But we do have a band, and we do play around town.
And the Iron Post? Where else?
We play at the Iron Post, and we've played at the Cowboy Monkey, and Memphis on Main, and some other clubs.
Do you know where you're playing next and when?
We actually are playing at the Iron Post on May 10th. And we're beginning at 6 o'clock and playing till about 9 o'clock.
And so people who had questions that they couldn't ask you here on the air could, between sets, ask you questions at the Iron Post.
Absolutely. All listeners should feel free to storm the stage. Well, not quite storm the stage, but certainly engage me at the Iron Post with any questions or comments.
And you'll be playing guitar.
And I'll be the person who will be clutching one of the guitars.
Do you sing back up?
The band doesn't like me to, but I try to sometimes. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith has been Professor David Wilson, urban geographer, talking about gentrification. I want to thank him and our 8 callers for their good questions and comments and the discussion today here on Keeping the Faith. Next week, our guest will be Father James Ellison of the Antiochian Orthodox Church. That'll be May 11th. We'll have an archive program on May 18th when I'll be up in Chicago enjoying a wedding, family wedding. May 25th, Wayne Wagers will be our guest talking about institutional design and evaluation of churches. Author Mark Gungor, G-U-N-G-O-R, who has a recent book out on marriage and relationships, will be our guest by phone. That's June 1st. And June 8th, Professor of Dance Philip Johnson will be our guest here on Keeping the Faith. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these programs. I'm the executive director of the University YMCA for just a few more months. They actually had a retirement party for me just a week or so ago while there were still students around to say goodbye to and some faculty who will be gone when I actually quit in August, late August. I've been asked whether I'll be continuing to volunteer to host this program and after I officially retire from the Y, and I think I will for a while at least. My spouse, who's a microbiologist, will be continuing to work for a year or so to help get some of her PhD students farther along before she retires. And so I'll be helping out here with Keeping the Faith with the help of others. Remember the Y's Dump and Run program that starts Monday, tomorrow. Bring things to the Y between 8:30 and 4, furniture, household goods, anything you students can't take with you or you think students would like. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
These days, everybody wants to make a movie, and with today's technology, just about anyone can. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, The Rise of the Indie Film. Chris Gore talks about My Big Fat Independent Movie, and we'll meet a former waitress who spent her life savings to make a movie about the food service industry. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 on WILL Urbana. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, clear with a low of 42 degrees and winds from the southwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly sunny and warmer, the high 72 with southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour with gusts to 25 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly to mostly cloudy, the low around 50, and Tuesday, mostly cloudy with a chance of a few showers and thunderstorms.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Billy Baruz, Champaign; Inuka Incorporated, Fairmount; Illini Studio, Champaign; Risk Management Commodities, Lafayette; and Remax Realty Associates, Champaign. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
It's 6 p.m. This American Life is next.